Here.
Hi, good morning. This is the Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue, Monday, May 21st, 2007. The time is going fast. At this time, I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2228. Tell us about this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2228 increases the authority of county assessors to extend time for filing tax returns until April 15th if sufficient cause exists to do so, or if doing so will enhance the accuracy of filing and taxpayer compliance. It grants the department the authority to grant the April 15th extension to companies with property located in more than one county or to companies that are subject to the department's assessment. So we're basically talking about centrally assessed property here.
That was simple enough. Come on over. Let's shoot. Let's never shoot. I don't care about his property.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, Senator Monroe, John Phillips of the Department of Revenue. This bill, 2228, is passed the House 54-0. It's part of the governor's regulatory streamlining package. It is focused on helping taxpayers file timely. Sometimes there are urgent situations that occur, illness, tragedy of some sort, and the law allows for the assessors and the department to grant extensions for filing returns for those reasons. The law goes a little bit further and allows the Department of Revenue for our accounts to grant extensions for other reasons, like what we refer to as administrative need. Let's say the end-of-year books aren't completed, and we can grant an extension for that. But comparatively speaking, the assessors can't grant extensions for those reasons. This bill would extend the assessor's authority to grant extensions for taxpayers for other than those tragedy situations where it's more administrative in nature and where it's more likely to be a reoccurring event. So every year they find themselves being asked for an extension. The assessors are saying we can't grant it for that reason. And so it causes a problem for the filing. And so this is a win-win for taxpayers, and it helps the assessors get more accurate information because the return is actually filed timely and completely. Secondly, the bill does one other thing mainly, and that is for companies that file returns in multiple counties, if you file in 10 counties, let's say, then you have to file a request for an extension with each assessor. If you get 5 out of the 10 granted, for whatever reason, then you've got a problem because the material is the same almost. So anyway, this would allow for those companies that have multiple county presence, it would allow the Department of Revenue to grant those extensions on behalf of that company for all counties. The assessors have worked with us on this concept, and they're behind it, and it just seems to be makes sense for taxpayers.
Senator Monroe.
No, I'm fine. As soon as we get a third person here, we can just move this and on down the road.
Mm-hmm. That's a good idea.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Monroe.
All right. Is there anyone else that would like to testify on House Bill 2228? All right. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on 2228, but we may be coming back with a work session. With tap the gavel, we will close that public hearing on 2228. And I'm going to open up a public hearing on 2231.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. 2231 amends ORS 308.146 by changing the deadline for filing an application with the county assessor to have real or personal property assessed after it has been damaged or destroyed. The application may be filed the later of August 1st of the current assessment year or before the 60th day following the date on which the property was destroyed or damaged. The application deadlines are changed to be consistent with the deadlines proposed in this bill. Under current law, if a property is damaged or destroyed between January and July 1, the property owner has until October 1st of the current tax year to file the application with the assessor. But after July 1st, well, then there's a problem. You have to wait till the following year.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Greg Thummel with the Department of Revenue. I'm the conference officer, and this is a companion bill with 2230, I believe it was, that allowed people who missed this deadline to apply for hardship to the Department of Revenue. This bill simply extends the deadline a little bit for those who have had an event that damaged or destroyed their property late towards the end of June or in June, in the June time frame, because under the statute, there is currently an August 1 deadline, which works fine if you if your property is damaged or destroyed early in the year, in January, February.
Mm-hmm.
Once you get up towards June, if your property burns down, there is a significant amount of hardship going on at that period of time, and the department felt that it would be more beneficial to allow a deadline to of 60 days after that event. So this that's what this bill does.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Monroe.
So essentially what's happening now is in some circumstances, depending on the timing, mm-hmm. a person could have their home destroyed and end up having to pay a whole another year's taxes on it.
Mr. Chair, Senator Monroe, excuse me, that is correct.
Yeah,
yeah, if they miss the deadline. And this would extend their deadline.
Good bill should pass.
Good bill should pass. Great, I'll just have you stay there.
Okay.
I'm hoping we're going to get a committee here. Or we're going to be taking a little break. Okay. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2231 for the tap of the gavel. And we're going to open up a public hearing on 2232. Great. Oh, yes, go ahead. Let's go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2232 permits the Boards of Property Tax Appeals to waive penalties on delinquent real property if it is both the first time that the tax return was required and the first time that the taxpayer filed the return. It applies to penalties associated with tax years beginning on or after 2007.
Okay. Again, I'm Greg Thummel. And for this bill, basically what we are doing is trying to conform ORS 308-295 with changes that were made to ORS 308-296 back in 2003. In 2003, businesses came forward with a need for certain leniency or consideration for first-time filers of personal property tax returns. And so ORS 308-296 was amended to allow the Boards of Property Tax Appeals to consider the needs of first-time filers in granting waivers of penalties. However, what was omitted from that bill back in 2003 was the fact that there are two other returns that carry penalties for late filing for which the board can consider a waiver. Those are for the real property returns and the combined property returns that are filed with the Department of Revenue. The power of the board to consider those waivers is in 308-295 rather than 308-296. So for 2 years we've been telling the boards that if the penalty was on a personal property tax return, they can consider waiving the penalty either for good cause or if they are a first-time filer. However, if the penalty was for late filing of a real property return or a personal or a combined return, they could only consider good cause and could not consider whether or not the filer was a first-time filer. This would conform 308-295 to 308-296 so that the Boards of Property Tax Appeals have the same decisions to make regardless of which type of return was late. They can waive the penalty for good cause, or if they are a first-time filer and it was the first year they had to file, regardless of the type of return that it was that they had to file.
Senator Monroe.
First-time filer, is there a greater likelihood that they would miss a deadline or a greater likelihood that they wouldn't know that they were supposed to file? Or give me some circumstances that would that under which this bill would be would help.
For many businesses that are just starting in Oregon, a person has been a salaried worker and decides to open their own shop. A business has been outside the state and first moves into the state.
Mm-hmm.
They are dealing with a multitude of statutes that they need to comply with. They first are learning about the withholding for their employees and all of that. These returns, personal property returns and real property returns, are something that often fall through the cracks the first year until the assessor notifies them that indeed they have an obligation to file these returns as well.
Okay. That's helpful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We're just stalling.
Would you like me to
regale
you with other stories?
Well, let us go straight on then. I'm going to close the... any further questions?
No, that's fine.
Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2232, and we're going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2237.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2237A, in Section 1, eliminates the annual filing requirement for a veteran's exemption not to exceed $15,000 on assessed value of homestead or personal property if three conditions are satisfied. First, a war veteran must have been granted the homestead exemption in the previous year. Second, the war veteran claiming the exemption must satisfy the requirements for having the disabilities of 40% or more, or a surviving spouse must continue to meet the qualifications for the exemption. And third, the ownership and use of the homestead, personal property, and all other qualifying conditions of the property must remain unchanged. Basically, what this bill is trying to do is not require the exemption to be filed annually.
Mm-hmm. We have John and Jeff. Come on up. Why don't you have both of you, John? You want to come on up, too? Of course, I should have you guys do it one at a time so we could kind of space this out.
Is the star in the building?
Senator Starr is out of the...
I can understand that.
And Senator Burdick is in her committee, I believe, judiciary. So we should have our committee coming back in just a few minutes. But in the meantime, I was just kidding. Come on up.
I just assumed wait to have...
Would you? Okay.
Good morning again, Mr. Chair. Senator Monroe, John Phillips of the Oregon Department of Revenue. This bill, 2237, passed the House 56-0. It is also part of the governor's streamlining package. It was suggested by the Department of Revenue because we've noticed over the years that we get a lot of requests for review of hardship situations for veterans who have missed filing. And we looked at this one carefully in terms of the policy, and we think that an annual filing requirement makes the most sense when you have circumstances for the applicant that change or are likely to change. We looked at this one particularly closely because disabilities don't typically go away in these cases, and surviving spouses are eligible until they remarry. And so this program is specifically targeted at disabled veterans, war veterans, or their surviving spouse. And the disability can be either service-connected or not service-connected. It's a partial exemption, and that partial exemption has been reviewed over the past sessions, but it's a partial exemption, and they file annually, and typically nothing changes. So there's about 37,000 Oregonians who file, and this bill would eliminate that annual filing requirement unless the circumstance changes.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Monroe.
This is a program for veterans who have served during wartime.
Mr. Chair, Senator Monroe, I believe it is, yes, it's war veterans specifically, and there's a definition in the law for war veterans. It does include World War I, World War II, Korean War, or any service of 210 active duty service since 1955.
Mm-hmm. That could be Vietnam, Iraq.
I think it could be, but I would have to go back and look and see that definition's changed.
Yeah, more than those days. Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
There is a bill before you. This session, you heard this last week, 2938, that changes that threshold up a little bit for the partial exemption, but it's dealing with the same program. This only deals with the annual filing requirement. So if I can answer any questions.
Okay.
Thanks. Thank you very much.
Good morning,
Mr. Chairman, Senator Monroe, Revenue Staff. I appreciate Senator Monroe. I'm Jeff Bodenweiser, retired disabled veteran of the Vietnam War, retired Marine captain, and I am very much in favor of this bill as far as it does eliminate the annual filing requirement, because it would save not only the veterans a great deal of discomfort if they miss the filing date, as you see, and also, and I think it's even They give us a couple of years in between. So it's not every year that they have to file for the 40% or more. It's every 3 years or something like that. And I missed it this year. I got it that year. That. And it's confusing. So, and disabled veterans sometimes have a lot of difficulty understanding the law as it's written, as you understand. So that part is fine. It would save the veterans a lot of trouble. It would save the court people, the county workers a lot of administrative difficulty, and postage, because they have to mail out these renewal notices and not always get them to the same address. But anyway, fine, up to that point. But this latest amendment, which changes the definition of veteran, Senator Monroe is quite wise to bring that up. Line 6 changes the definition of who would be able or eligible for this disability tax relief to war veterans. Hell, I'm not a war veteran. I was in Vietnam. That's not a war. Mm-hmm. Korean War veterans weren't in a war, a declared war. That's They'd right. be out of this program. And that is plain and simple. They'd all lose this exemption with this law as changed.
Yeah.
And
police action, right?
That's it. Mm-hmm. And these people in Iraq and Afghanistan returning with traumatic brain injuries, loss of eyes, limbs, would all be lost to this program by that simple change that has been inserted, seemingly innocuous, saying war veterans. Yeah, we all think that we were at war, and we are at war. When this country was severely attacked September 11th, 2001, that, to me, was an act of war against our country, and we lost a lot of people, almost as many people in 10 minutes as we've lost in years over in Iraq and Afghanistan. So if this proceeds with the amendment changing the veteran who is eligible for this to limiting it to war veterans, when's the last declared war we had? World War II, right?
Yep.
Right. And there's not many of those veterans left. So if this goes forward, it would be traumatic. I mean, I can't begin to tell you the terrible effect that would have. Thank you.
John, is that the problem? Is that
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that is a very serious concern. It was not the intention to change that in the law, and we don't think it does. We think in the statute that actually grants exemption, which is the one just ahead of the one in the bill, 307-250, is where it actually uses the word war veteran.
And does it define it?
And the definition is found in another statute, and it would include all of the service that I'm sorry, your name is?
Bodenweiser.
Mr. Bodenweiser mentioned, and that's any active duty since 1955.
Mm-hmm.
We'd be happy to talk with you or legislative council about that, but all this was trying to do was conform 260 to what 307-250 already required. So there was no intention to limit in any way that, and I think if we looked at, which I don't have 307-250 with me, but I think it does say war veteran.
At this very moment, in another hearing, there's a bill proposed to drastically change the operation of the Department of Veterans Affairs with the encouragement of a lot of people. And I'm very much opposed to the changes they're making there as well, because it's gutting the Department of Veterans Affairs, essentially. But they have, as part of a House Bill 3294, a clarification of the definition of veteran to mean veteran means a person who served on active duty with the armed forces of the United States for a period of more than 178 consecutive days and was discharged or released from active duty with other than a dishonorable discharge. B, for 178 days or less and was discharged or released from active duty with other than a dishonorable discharge because of a service-connected disability. And that means that it would enable them to bring in people who are severely injured, killed, or severely injured and returned to society, resulting from injuries or problems that turn up on the initial period of active duty, which would be excluded under this as well. I mean, if we're going to limit it to war veterans, we're wiping out a lot of people who would have this eligibility. And further says, as used in this section, active duty does not include attendance at a school under military orders except schooling incident to an active enlistment or regular tour of duty or normal military training as a reserve officer or a member of an organized reserve or National Guard unit. So, say you're going to school on a full ride on the taxpayers and you'd never serve a day of active duty, it would eliminate that section under this new definition, because there are people who go through Annapolis, go through West Point, full ride, expense to us, hundreds of thousands of dollars every year being spent on each of those students. And there are some people who come up to graduation day with that education saying, screw it, I don't want any part of this war, and I'm out of here, and resigning their commissions. Excuse my language, please. And the effect of this would be to the new definition would eliminate those people from eligibility, which I certainly agree with. If that definition of veteran prevails, which I fully believe it will, why strike veteran from this bill and make it war veteran? Each war veteran is just a very narrow group, and I saw people down at the Armed Forces Day down at Corvallis the other day, and a World War II veteran proudly serving. He still qualifies, still would deserve this. He's lost his hip socket through deterioration and that sort of thing and injuries, and just really immobilized. But, and I would not want to take it away from him. But on the other hand, these people coming home with missing limbs and traumatic brain injuries, as you saw in 60 Minutes a while ago, these people look perfectly normal, and they are, with the exception of their brain has been severely damaged by these concussion grenades. We used to call those people shell-shocked. I don't know if that names it.
Yeah, I remember that.
And World War II, and since then, why that has gone away, and now PTSD and TBI and some of these others are disabilities that are just as severe as losing a limb and so on. So if without that change to limiting it to war veterans, it would be a fine bill. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Monroe.
I would request that we set this bill over and not act on it today, and have the department check this very carefully. And we want to make it absolutely, absolutely crystal clear that we're covering all people that were in conflict on behalf of the United States, whether it be Vietnam, Korea, Iraq, whatever.
Thank you very much.
Let me ask you a question. If, in fact, a definition is what is listed in that is World War I to Korea, Korea served 210 days active duty since 1955. If it is that broad, I mean, we're okay. We just need to get that clarified. Would that be your understanding, that as long as we maintain that definition?
Yes, and I think that this proposed change of veteran expands it even a bit more to include those who are, they can be severely injured in training, say they're going through recruit training, and suffer a disability. And they've volunteered, because these people are not being drafted these days. Everyone who's serving us these days is a volunteer who is putting his or her life on the line for our country. Some people would question the value of their service at this time, which is really. Yeah. But anyway, I think that the new definition would expand to cover those people, but not those who drop out of West Point.
I think everyone can see the reasonableness of that. If I hire a person that comes to work for me voluntarily, and that person is injured in training, that person is covered with workers' comp. It's not the exact parallel, but it is a parallel morally, that in fact there is an obligation, and we certainly don't want to limit that.
And I guess
you want to say something?
No.
Oh, okay.
disabled American veterans, the veterans of foreign wars, the American Legion, Military Order of World Wars, all have gotten away from the strict requirements of war veteran for obvious reasons, because those organizations would be shrinking beyond. And I hope that we're here to stay, and I live a long life. Thank you very much.
We'll take care. You're doing great so far. Mr. Phillip, a question for you. Now, you indicated that there might have been that wording problem in one of the other House bills that we had heard previously. Did it go? Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, John Phillips, Department of Revenue. I mentioned Senate House Bill 2938.
Oh, okay.
But that's in a package of bills right. That is being reviewed by the House Revenue Committee. And all that did is change a number in this exemption program.
Mm-hmm.
It moves it up so that there's additional, the threshold is higher. Yeah. Okay. What might be useful, Mr. Chair, is that if Legislative Council could possibly weigh in on that word, mm-hmm. because it was not our intention or anybody discussed changing the program itself in any substantive way. So,
and I really appreciate that, and I hope that in good conscience, you gentlemen represent what I would like to see a lot of the legislators feeling about this, but somebody obviously has decided that they want to shrink the benefits to veterans by limiting it to war veterans, and that simple one word makes a big difference.
Mr. Chair, I'm an old American history professor, and I know the difference between a declared war and undeclared war, and people die just the same, fight just as hard either way, and we'll make sure and take care of it.
Thank you. And I think it's also a point well taken that we ought to look at any other legislation pending in this that might have slipped by to this point, because if any of the bills that are going to take away benefits that have been earned by veterans of everything, Korea, Vietnam, current occupation, are being stricken by that simple change to war veteran, we're in serious trouble. Thank you very much.
Mr. Badenow, before you guys leave, Paul, would it be possible to call Legislative Council and see if they might drift down there for a second and see if we can get this clarified? Or if they could come up?
I'm not a lawyer, but I tell you, when I saw that...
When in doubt, ask questions.
That's right.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. Okay. Well, we're going to put House Bill 2237A on hold, so I'll close that public hearing.
Can we go back and now with Jenny's here?
Jenny, are you okay to go back? We heard the previous three, 2228, 2231, and 32.
I'm just fine with that, Mr. Chair.
All right, we are. Then we're going to open up a work session on House Bill 2228. Recognize Senator Monroe.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2228 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Is there any further discussion? Any questions about it? Okay. Clerk will call the roll. 2228. Sorry about that. Yeah, we're at a work session on 2228.
But we're getting an LC.
Oh, okay. It's wonderful. Thank you.
Okay. Senator Burdick.
Aye.
Senator Monroe.
Aye.
Chair Dorick.
Aye. House Bill 2228, having received the required vote, will in fact go to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Carrier for that bill?
I'll carry it if you'd
like. Senator Monroe. Okay, that work session is closed on 2228, and I'll open up a work session on House Bill 2231. Senator Monroe.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2231 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Any further questions or comments on 2231? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Senator Burdick.
Aye.
Senator Monroe.
Aye.
Senator
Dorick. Aye. House Bill 2231 is sent to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. We need a carrier.
I'll carry that.
Okay. Senator Burdick, thank you very much. Close the work session on House Bill 2231 and open up a work session on House Bill 2232.
Mr. Chair, I would move...
Whoops is not an official number, though. You need...
House Bill 2232 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
All right. Any further discussion? Okay, clerk, call the roll. House Bill 2232 without a whoops.
Senator Burdick.
Aye. Aye.
Aye. Okay, House Bill 2232 will be going to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Carrier.
Do you want me to do it or do you want to?
I can do it. Okay, okay. I'll carry it. Very good. Now, at this time, I'm going to go ahead and close the work session on House Bill 2232, and we will open up a public hearing on House Bill 2095.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2095A and growth allows a housing authority to own, operate, and or manage a mixed-income housing property by forming partnership agreements with limited liability companies and nonprofits. It replaces an annual report with an independent audit requirement. It changes definitions such as slummed, blighted areas, and it restricts the use of housing the term housing authority to an entity that has been created by the legislature under specific statute. Changes the definition of persons of eligible income from persons who cannot cover the cost of housing, including utilities and taxes, for less than 25% of gross income, to persons whose income are less than 80% of median area income, adjusted for family size. The proposed change conforms to revised federal statutes. It repeals ORS 456-170, which is stated at the bottom, which is basically the section that says that an annual report has to be filed, and it's been replaced in the bill with an independent audit. There's a dash 4 amendment which clarifies a certain sentence in section 4.1, subset B, which retains the words general partner, director, or manager, and expands the legal status and or role of the housing authority to include it's being a limited partner, a member, or a general manager of a mixed-income housing property. And for those of you who may not know, a mixed-income housing property means that apparently that it can be property that can be rented to higher or lower income earning households or possibly even commercial. I'm not sure if that's it, Mr. Chair.
Well, it appears that this is a tremendous increase in authority and an increase in the median income level.
Actually, it's changing the threshold. It sounds like it may be a lot, but if you looked at, let's say, 80% of 25% of gross income, that means your housing utilities and income should not be more than 25% of your income, but 80% of median income for a family adjusted for size could be very close. It's not really.
It's apples and oranges.
Yes, it's difference in federal guidelines, and that's really what the intent of that was, to bring it up to compatibility.
Okay.
As far as the authority goes, I'm not sure you could be right on that. However, I think in some cases, the housing authorities are trying to engage in certain relationships and entities have created limited liability companies, and we had a bill a session ago where that came up, where it's just a format, and it's giving them the ability to engage in arrangements with companies that have different legal entities.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Monroe.
Yeah, mixed use means some is identified as low-income housing and, you know, qualifies for low-income housing, and some is what they call market housing. Mm-hmm. And usually you find this in projects that have been subsidized in some way. And part of the price for getting a subsidy, if I'm a builder creating such a project, is I have to agree to have a certain percentage of my units be, quote, affordable.
Mm-hmm.
Affordable meeting this criteria. Current, for a family of four, median income somewhere around $40,000.
If you're talking about median income in the state, it's about $42,000. And if you're looking at federal guidelines, I don't think I have that form with me.
80% of area median income is what this says.
Right, 80%, so it'd have to be 80% of 40 is
so about 33,000. They'd have to be a family of four earning less than that amount would qualify. On the other hand, if they were spending 25% of their income for housing, including utilities and everything, 25% of 32,000, yeah, that would be about 600 and $650, $700, and you can't get rent a place big enough for a family of four, including all utilities and everything for that. So, yeah, mm-hmm. and tax. Yeah, so actually, the thresholds of 25% and the 80% of median are really very close.
Well, let's hear from John Fletcher, Phil Donovan, James Hackett. I think you folks are together, so we can have you come on up and tell us what we don't understand about it. House Bill 2095.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm John Fletcher with Oregon Housing and Community Services Department. I'm the Senior Policy Advisor for the department. And just to give you a little background on this bill, during the past interim, our department worked with a number of different partners to talk about affordable housing. What can we do short of just asking for more money that could help our partners deliver affordable housing better? And one of the partners we talked to were the housing authorities. They're a good partner working group with us throughout the state. Over the past 10 years, they've helped us develop over 2,100 units of affordable housing. They're good partners in that they watch over these projects once they're built and ensure that the tenants meet the income guidelines that are set for the programs and so forth. And as we met with the housing authorities and asked them what we might be able to do, we looked through the statutes at a number of housekeeping changes, but there were a couple of areas that they thought could possibly help in delivering affordable housing. One related to mixed income developments. Now, there's a difference between mixed income and mixed use. Mixed income is talking about different ranges of incomes, and mixed use is the combination of residential and commercial. And here we're talking about mixed income developments. And with mixed income developments, currently housing authorities can fund those or finance those projects, but they can't own them themselves. And this change that we're proposing in the bill would allow them to not only finance these projects, but own them as well. And in some circumstances, that could just make it that much easier to facilitate a project coming forward. It may make the difference on a few projects. It's not going to greatly change the marketplace, as far as we can tell, with respect to affordable housing, but it was a little change that they thought would benefit. Another change that the bill makes allows the housing authorities to work through limited liability corporations. Previously, they had to work through partnerships. This expands just their ability to work with their partners one step further. And the industry has been moving towards limited liability corporations in this type of work. So that's another thing that facilitates just a little bit more the kinds of things that they're involved with in the marketplace. As we got into the session, there were a couple of other suggested changes, and so there were some amendments on the House side. One related to the name housing authorities, and there have been some instances where certain groups are trying to claim that they are housing authorities and they aren't. And this protection of the name, kind of like a copyright of the name housing authorities, sets up what those standards are. Means that they have to meet the requirements given in statutes for a housing authority. And so that was an amendment that just came to light, given something that came up during the session. So that amendment was made on the House side. There's an amendment that the housing authorities are going to speak to this morning that also came up as the bill was reviewed further, and that allows certain terms like general manager to be included as they work with these limited liability corporations. Altogether, there are some housekeeping changes and a few minor tweaks, but there's no additional money or revenue impact or fiscal impact associated with this bill. We feel, though, we'd like to urge the support of this bill to enable housing authorities to continue their good work in providing affordable housing. The department wants to lend their support in favor of this bill, too. I'd be happy to answer any questions, but I think you'll probably want to be talking to the housing authorities directly, too. So with that, I'll conclude my testimony and let you hear from the other panelists.
Yes, Senator Burnett.
Thank you. Is there a requirement in here for a specific percentage that has to be low income? It'll be mixed income in the. Is there any kind of threshold to prevent them from just going into the commercial housing business?
Chair George, Senator Burdick, for the record, my name is Phil Donovan. I'm here on behalf of the Association of Oregon Housing Authorities, and you are correct. There are standards, higher standards, to ensure that with these mixed income developments that we're truly trying to get at the poorest of the poor, if you will. If you refer to page 6, line 37, you can see this is where the change allows a housing authority to not only just finance but also to own, operate, and manage a mixed-income housing project. And you can see there that the standards for this are different than the basic definition of affordable housing, which is eligible households at 80% of median income. But rather, you can see here in sub A, B, and C, A and B, that require that you get at 50% and 60%.
Okay. Thank you for pointing that out. So it's basically the same requirements that currently exist for them to finance it. It's just adding the ownership piece.
Okay. George, Senator Burke, that's correct.
Thank you.
Good. Okay. Phil, you want to go ahead?
Sure, I'll dive in. Chair George, members of the committee, thank you very much again. My name is Phil Donovan. Here on behalf of the Association of Oregon Housing Authorities, we provide housing to over 45,000 households across the state of Oregon, and we also manage the transfer of millions of dollars of federal funds that come in way of rent subsidies. During the legislative interim, three housing authority directors volunteered their time to work with Oregon Housing and Community Services and develop the proposed changes that you see in front of you. With me today is James Hackett. He's the director of the Lynn Benton Housing Authority, and he's one of those housing authority directors that volunteered his time. I think legislative revenue staff has done an excellent job of covering the contents of the legislation. If I could just very briefly offer a little perspective on a few aspects of the bill for the record. First off, in Section 2, you'll notice that there's a requirement of an annual housing authority report, which frankly is very duplicative of what we were already providing the U.S. Housing and Urban Development Agency in the way of an independent audit of our both the housing authority's finances and also of its activities. So that's why that change is being proposed. You've already heard a little bit about the use of the title of a housing authority. Frankly, our concern here is that some of the companies that have tried to adopt the title of housing authority are trying to lure in consumers of lower incomes. These are typically mortgage type companies, quite frankly, you wouldn't have an incorporated city, i.e. the City of McMinnville Mortgage Company, that would never stand because the city is incorporated. We're public entities as housing authorities, yet because we're not incorporated, we don't have that protection of the name. So that's why we've proposed that in 2095. Section 4 of the bill. This is, frankly, we've used partnerships for years and years, but it's an antique vehicle as far as the tax code is concerned, and so that's why the move to include nonprofit corporations and limited liability companies. Sections 5 and 6 simply update the Housing Authority statute definitions, which were first created in 1971, so we've come a long ways, and so this hopefully will help us out. One thing that I did want to, just for your information, highlight is given the recent closures of manufactured home parks and the loss of affordability that they represent, you'll notice that one of the definitions includes manufactured home parks in the list of what is housing. Because we know that if we have the means and the ability to help avert additional closures, we want to be partners in that effort, and so that's why that was changed. Section 7, something that hasn't been referred to, but just to quickly bring up, allows the appointing jurisdiction of a Housing Authority Board Commissioner so that they can just issue a resolution. Under current statute, you were supposed to file in every city and town within a district. Frankly, for some housing authorities are serving multiple counties, numerous jurisdictions, very difficult and unwieldy to live within the letter of the law. So we'll change it, hopefully, with your approval. And then finally, Section 8, which we just spoke about, strengthens our housing opportunities by allowing us to own and operate mixed-income housing developments. And one of the things that I would want to put on the record is this great thing about what mixed-income does is it allows us to get at very low-income people that, quite frankly, the housing market doesn't serve. Sections 9 and 10, they simply update the existing statute with these new definitions. And finally, just to speak to the Dash A4 amendments, one of our attorneys noticed that legislative council deleted some titles that are currently being used for existing developments. So what the A4s do is just basically include all the different titles that are used in the development of housing authority properties. And so hopefully you would please adopt this amendment, make it a clean bill. Get it through and across the finish line. Thank you.
Any questions? Mr.
Hackett? Chair George, for the record, my name is James Hackett. I'm the executive director of the Lynn Benton Housing Authority in Albany, Oregon. And I was part of the team that worked on drafting this legislation, and I'm only here to answer the difficult questions. So if there aren't any difficult questions, then my role is...
You do favor the passage of the bill, and you do favor the amendment?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. The amendment basically reinstates language that's already in the current statutes. So we're not adding anything new. What we're saying is we had some things taken out that weren't supposed to be taken out.
Mm-hmm. Okay, is there anyone else who would like to testify on House Bill 2095A? Okay, I'm going to. The chair has asked that he be present when we rehear 2095. So at that point, at this point, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2095.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Before you do that, in case I'm not here when it is reconsidered, I do have a potential conflict of interest on this. I have no idea what this would do, but I have to my situation. But I have a small interest in a low income. Housing development that might be sold to a housing authority.
So. Very good. So noted. We're closing the public hearing on House Bill 2095. And our status on we. John? Okay.
Commiserating with LC.
Oh, I didn't see. Okay. And that's. 2237.
Yeah.
I'm going to go ahead and reopen the hearing on that. Tap of the gavel. House Bill 2237A is open for public hearing.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Legislative Council just went back to get the definition of war veteran, but I think they understand what they drafted, and she'll be returning shortly.
Okay. If we could stand at ease then for a few minutes, if everybody can have a cup of tea or so on, we'll tap of the gavel, we'll be at ease. Again on 2237, correct?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Hi. State the name for the record.
Good morning, Chair George, members of the committee. My name is Janelle Barton. I'm with Legislative Council's office, and I'm here to answer your questions. I understand that the question before the committee was whether the addition of the word war to the term veteran changed the persons who are eligible for the homestead exemption.
Right.
And it does not. Short answer. Basically, what war veteran does is it makes the statute correspond with ORS 307-250, which is the section that defines who is eligible for the exemption. If you look at 307-260, I don't know if you have these statutes before you.
We just have the bill.
Okay. Subsection 1A of 307-260 says that each veteran or surviving spouse qualifying for the exemption under 307-250 shall file with the county assessor. If you look over at 307-250,
it says that the persons who qualify for the exemption are, under subparagraph A to subsection 1, or paragraph A, any war veteran who is officially certified. Paragraph B, any war veteran. Paragraph C, any surviving spouse of a war veteran. So the addition of war veteran to 307.260 does not change the definition. And if we look at the definition of war veteran in the 174.105, which is the part of the standard definitions for Oregon statutes, war veteran is defined to include those who served in World War I, World War II, the Korean conflict, and anybody who served 210 days, which was subsequent to January 31st, 1955. It also includes, if you look at subparagraph 2 of 174.105, it also includes those who were injured or who became ill while on active service, even if they didn't complete that 210-day minimum service. It does not include those who are in a military college, university, right, military training, mm-hmm, and for college purposes. I hope that answers your question.
Well, that's clear to me.
Mr. Chair, let's go.
Well, Mr. Chair, this makes it very clear that this program is available to people that served in Korea, in Vietnam, in Iraq, and we just wanted to make sure that that was clear and on the record, that the change in language didn't affect who was covered. So with that, Mr. Chair, if we want to go to a work session.
Let's go to a work session. I'm going to close the public hearing on the House Bill 2237 and open a work session on House Bill 2237.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2237 to the floor.
A.
To the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation, only if I get to carry it.
Thank you, guys. Any further discussion?
I want to carry it, Mr. Chair.
I'm the chair here today. All right. The one who asks first. Clerk, we'll call the roll.
Senator Brick.
Aye.
Senator McDowell.
Aye.
Judge
Rush. Aye. Okay. Aaron Gross, House Bill 2237 will be headed to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and the carrier will be Senator Monroe because he spoke
very much.
Is there any further business to come before the committee? Okay. Seeing none, we'll be adjourned.
This will be easy to-